During the course of a career that spanned more than a half century, Grappelli would create an impressive, diverse body of work that found him in collaboration with modernists, Gary Burton, McCoy Tyner, classicists, Yehudi Menuhin, Yo-Yo Ma, practitioners of roots music, David Grisman, Mark O'Connor, and of course traditionalists from his own generation, Earl Hines, Bill Coleman. Born in Belgium on January 23, 1910, and raised in a gypsy settlement outside Paris, Jean-Baptiste Gengo Reinhardt was playing professionally even before his teens. He enjoyed little formal education in music, or in other areas for that matter. Reinhardt was illiterate and signed his name with an X. But he picked up an odd assortment of skills in billiards, in fishing, in music, at which he greatly excelled. His musical pursuits began with violin and eventually gravitated to the guitar. In 1928, Gengo's left hand was severely injured in a caravan fire, essentially depriving him of the use of two fingers. Yet Reinhardt's music would show few signs of compromise with this disability, other than a reliance on chords that used just two or three fingers, emphasizing sixths and ninths in a manner that has often been imitated by later performers working in this style. Gengo's supple guitar technique stood out for its speed and assertiveness, and at a time when this instrument was seen more as an accompanist than as a significant solo voice in jazz bands, Reinhardt demonstrated his skill in constructing horn-oriented single-note lines. His rhythmic approach was equally distinctive, and the rapid up-and-down strumming style of accompaniment, known as la pompe, has become a trademark of gypsy jazz, or jazz manouche, the French name by which it is often known. Reinhardt's earliest recordings, accompanying an accordionist and slide whistle player, are far removed from the cosmopolitan jazz of his later years. But by the time of the first quintet session in 1934, he had come to terms with the African-American idiom. On Dinah, he intermingles bouncy triplets and bluesy asides with forceful octaves, setting a standard for ease of execution and invention that would be amplified in later quintet recordings such as Jangology, Limehouse Blues, Chicago, and Minor Swing. In time, the influence of Ravel, Debussy, and Gershwin would impart an impressionist tinge to Reinhardt's jazz, revealed in his exploration of whole tone scales and in the languorous beauty of his most famous composition, Nuage. Reinhardt would not tour overseas until after World War II, but by then he had already played with many of the luminaries of jazz during their European visits, and had developed an international reputation. Before the war, Reinhardt had recorded with Benny Carter, Coleman Hawkins, Dickie Wells, and members of the Duke Ellington Band. Ellington remained a great admirer of Reinhardt's. Duke lauded him as among the few great inimitables of our music. And when the guitarist decided to tour the United States in November 1946, it was in tandem with the Ellington Band. Here he adopted an electric guitar and performed in large auditoriums, including Carnegie Hall. Returning to France, Reinhardt continued to play in small clubs and undertake occasional recordings. At his death in 1953, attributed to a cerebral hemorrhage, he was only 43 years old. Grappelli and Reinhardt had parted ways at the outbreak of World War II, the violinist staying in England, where the band had been on tour, while Gengo returned to France. A few weeks earlier, Coleman Hawkins had departed for the United States, arriving stateside only days before Germany's invasion of Poland. The rise of Nazism did not bode well for jazz musicians in Europe. Hawkins himself had been denied the right to perform in Germany because his appearance with white musicians was deemed unsuitable. Reinhardt, for his part, managed to continue his career under the Nazi occupation, but was forced to submit his song selections to the local censorship bureau before each performance. Indeed, jazz took on surprising political significance in this charged environment, with W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues getting rechristened as La Tristesse de Saint-Louis by musicians who hoped that a French-sounding name might avoid a crackdown by authorities, while Reinhardt's Nuage was adopted by some partisans as a defiant alternative anthem after the authorities banned La Marseillaise. Hawkins encountered a much different set of challenges back on his native soil. After an absence of 5 years, he needed to reestablish himself at home in the face of tenorists who had risen to prominence during his European sojourn. Chu Berry, with a rough-and-tumble sound akin to Hawkins's, was among the best of these new aspirants to the throne. Berry had served in the Fletcher Henderson Band in the mid-1930s, before joining Cab Calloway in 1937, with whom he remained until his death in a car accident in 1941. The Calloway Association paid well, but Berry's hard-swinging approach might have been better served in another setting, One wonders what magic might have resulted had Barry accepted Ellington's job offer in the mid-1930s. Ben Webster, who would soon join the Ellington band, also had drawn inspiration from Hawkins, but parted ways from his role model with a breathier, unhurried tone that would become even more languid with the passing years. Webster stepped back from the harmonic acrobatics of Hawkins and the linearity of Young in favor of a celebration of sound. Like a Japanese shakuhachi master, Webster sought the essence of music in texture and timbre, not in well-tempered notes. But the most pressing challenge to Hawkins came again from Lester Young, whose playing had become more confident and distinctive in the intervening years since their Kansas City encounter. Shortly after his return to New York, Hawkins sought out Young in a jam session at the Famous Door. Their tenor battle was front-page news in Downbeat, and the jazz world debated who would emerge the victor. Within days of this engagement, Hawkins matched up with a number of the other top players of his day as part of a Lionel Hampton session that also included Chu Berry, Ben Webster, Benny Carter, Dizzy Gillespie, and Charlie Christian. But the most prominent sign that Hawkins was ready to meet all challengers came on October 11th when he kicked off a series of recordings for RCA's Bluebird label with a version of Body and Soul that became an instant hit with both the general public and musicians. "It's the first and only record I ever heard of that all the squares dig, as well as the jazz people," Hawkins later remarked. "I don't understand how and why." Certainly Hawkins made no compromises to popular tastes in his whirlwind 64-bar solo. It briefly touches on the melody in the opening seconds before taking off into a marvelously fluid thematic development, rich in harmonic implication and rigidly logical in construction, yet infused with an undercurrent of lush romanticism. Not only was this Hawkins's finest moment, but with Body and Soul, the tenorist created what is undoubtedly the most celebrated saxophone solo from the first half of the 20th century. At the peak of his career, Hawkins remained indecisive in his musical commitments. The next few years found him trying his hand at a wide range of formats, fronting a big band, participating in the Dixieland revival, engaging in small combo sessions akin to the Body and Soul date, and exploring the possibilities of modern jazz. Hawkins's flirtation with bebop stands out as one of the most intriguing chapters in his biography. Among the earliest band leaders to recognize the importance of the new idiom, Hawkins featured Dizzy Gillespie, as well as Max Roach, Oscar Pettiford, and Don Byas, on a momentous session from February 1944, which is usually acknowledged as the first modern jazz record date. A short while later, Hawkins hired pianist Thelonious Monk, at a time when the latter's eccentricities and modernist leanings made him persona non grata on most bandstands. Hawkins's advocacy of modern jazz continued the following year, when the tenorist brought the first bebop band to the West Coast, predating the more celebrated Gillespie-Parker Los Angeles engagement by some 10 months. During the post-war years, Hawkins further enhanced his progressivist credentials with another first, a jazz recording of unaccompanied saxophone. He first attempted this on a promotional demo disc made for the Selmer Company, a leading manufacturer of saxophones, in a two-part variation that includes Hawkins's improvisation over the chord changes of Monk's Round Midnight. He followed this performance with a commercial recording of solo saxophone, released under the title Picasso. In time, the jazz world would accept that horn players could perform without the support of a band, but though many would follow down this path, few were better suited for this approach than Hawkins, whose harmonically charged manner of improvisation allowed the listener to feel the pull of the chord changes, even when no accompanist was on hand to spell them out. Yet, for all his avant-garde leanings, Hawkins's conception of melodic improvisation never really adapted to the changed musical landscape of modern jazz. His deeply analytical musical mind allowed the tenorist to navigate through intricate, bop-oriented charts, but his phrasing and conception remained rooted in the swing era. Some have even tried to enshrine him as a progenitor of bebop, but Hawkins, much like Benny Goodman, never really mastered the characteristic rebalancing and subdivisions of the beat that set apart true bop tenorists such as Dexter Gordon, Teddy Edwards, and Sonny Rollins. The idea of modernism often seemed to hold more appeal for Hawkins than its actual execution. To the end, Hawkins enjoyed lingering near the cutting edge. Sessions from his last decade find him in the company of Sonny Rollins, Randy Weston, Paul Blay, and Joe Zawinul. But Hawkins was just as quick to retreat to traditional settings, and some of his most satisfying late-career recordings are alongside veterans such as Ben Webster, Roy Eldridge, and Duke Ellington. Lester Young's relationship to modern jazz stands out as almost the mirror image of Hawkins's. Young had little interest in being perceived as a modernist. His personal listening tastes tended toward popular songs and sentimental ballads. Yet his style of playing not only foreshadowed the coming of bebop, but to a certain extent inspired it. Of course, the lineage of Kansas City saxophone provides a direct connection between Young and bop progenitor Charlie Parker. But even more than geography, a shared sensibility links the two figures. Both use the higher intervals of the chords, the so-called color tones, as building blocks in their improvisations. But the harmonic context of their music was often implicit rather than explicit, as with Hawkins, for both employed a linear conception in which the augmented fifths, sixths, ninths, elevenths, and such were carefully integrated into taut improvised lines. Chords were never spelled out, merely implied, and even these harmonic hints could be so subtle as to pass notice. But the most significant change signaled by Young and developed by Parker came in the rhythmic construction of their phrases. The pronounced syncopations, which had dominated jazz since its New Orleans origins, were used more sparingly in their playing. The dotted eighth note lines, frequently adopted by Young's predecessors, were now replaced by a smoother delivery of notes. Emphasis was less likely to fall on the first beat of the bar. The improvised lines carried a more definite 4-4 feel. One now heard a far greater use of triplets to add vitality to the phrases, perhaps as a substitute for the mostly absent syncopations. All these conceptual elements, propagated by Young, would be taken up and pushed further by Parker. No, Young's music was not modern jazz. He remained, first and foremost, a product of the swing era. And even among Young's contemporaries, there were many, Hawkins, Tatum, and Ellington are the most prominent examples, with far more progressive views about jazz as a modern art form. But Young, more than any of these others, set a foundation on which the next generation of modernists could build. There is a second tradition in jazz that Young revitalized. Cool jazz would not emerge as a major force until the early 1950s, but even in the pre-war years, Young was pointing the way to this alternative style. More than any instrumentalist of his generation, Young served as the crucial link between the 1920s cool pioneers, Beiderbecke, Trumbauer, and their Cold War successors, Getz, Mulligan, Davis, Desmond, Baker, Jufri. In the 1930s, this was a lonely path to travel. Jazz has always been a hot art form, perhaps this is part of its essence, in its celebration of intensity, immediacy, and unbridled energy. The cool aesthetic, championing as it does a different set of virtues, has always been a minority point of view. The wholesale rejection of Young's style at the hands of his peers during his tenure in the Henderson Band capsulizes in a telling anecdote this very fact. By the time of Young's mature work, his more relaxed approach was especially out of favor. It was, after all, the swing era, a time when most jazz band leaders simply assumed that hotter was invariably better. That Young could rise above these obstacles and gain the admiration, eventually the emulation, of his peers with his cooler musical attitudes testifies to the lasting value of his innovations and to the determination of this supposedly unassuming protagonist in the history of jazz. Young's achievements with the Basie Band no doubt contributed to this expanding influence, but it is in his small combo sides that his alternative conception of jazz is most telling. His recordings with the Kansas City Six and Kansas City Seven from the late 1930s are major works. His clarinet playing from this period captures a laconic elegance, galaxies apart from the pyrotechnics of the Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw schools then in fashion, while his tenor efforts produced classic saxophone statements on Lester Leaps In and Dickie's Dream. Young is even more in the spotlight on his stellar trio recordings with pianist Nat King Cole from the early and mid-1940s. But perhaps the most unusual combo performance from this period finds Young and several Basie colleagues joining Goodman for a 1940 session that also featured Charlie Christian. This music, which was not released for many years, adds another valuable perspective on Young's saxophone work, which stands out, even in this elevated company, with its melodic inventiveness and effortless delivery. Young would continue to record in small combo settings during the late 1940s and throughout the 1950s, but few of those performances match these early excursions. Many have suggested that Young's disastrous experiences in the U.S. Army during the closing months of World War II precipitated a downward spiral in his playing. Although Young never came close to a battlefield during his 15-month tour of duty, almost every other misfortune befell him. He was injured while running an obstacle course, hospitalized, operated on, psychoanalyzed, disciplined, arrested for possession of marijuana and barbiturates, incarcerated, and finally given a dishonorable discharge. The result was that Young, already introverted, became even more withdrawn, even more caught up in the odd mannerisms and jargon of his inner world. His music also changed during the 1940s. His tone thickened and at times grew coarse. The melodic lines became less sprightly. The phrases sometimes sounded disjointed. But the chronology of this transformation is not as simple as has often been suggested. Some of these stylistic changes were already hinted at before Young's military service, while even after his discharge, the saxophonist was capable of performances of merit. Yet as Young approached his late 40s, these exalted moments grew increasingly rare. At times his playing sounded simply tired. Yet these were good years for Young's finances, largely due to impresario and producer Norman Granz, who utilized the saxophonist's talents in a wide range of commercial projects. In the decade leading up to his death in 1959, Young recorded and performed frequently and saw his stature in the jazz world rise in tandem with a growing respect for cool jazz. Beat Generation writers would laud him, and hipsters emulated his unusual style of speaking. One 1950s disciple, saxophonist Brew Moore, would go so far as to assert that anyone who doesn't play like Lester is wrong. Of all of Young's legacies from his best years, his recordings with singer Billie Holiday hold a special position in the jazz pantheon. Jazz fans admire them for their delicate intimacy, but even audiences blissfully ignorant of most aspects of the swing era have come to know and treasure these sides, and rightly so. The marriage of jazz and popular music, which occasionally leads to nuptial bliss, but too often takes on overtones of a shotgun wedding, has never been consummated with greater success than on these combo recordings. Even when weighed down by the most banal pop material, Holiday could transmute the dross of Tin Pan Alley into art song. She left a stamp so personal on many pieces that no later vocalist could attempt, All of Me, or Foolin' Myself, or Mean to Me, and a host of other songs, without inviting comparisons, inevitably unfavorable ones, with her definitive versions. Young's contributions on these sides are small when measured in notes, cooing phrases answering Holiday's vocal line, Without Your Love, an 8-bar solo to set off the bridge of a song, My First Impression of You, a simple melody statement, Foolin' Myself, a snippet of clarinet playing, I've Got a Date with a Dream, or just a tantalizing 4-bar introduction, When a Woman Loves a Man. But in terms of emotional power, these interludes are as persuasive as they come. Was there ever a jazz saxophonist better suited for demonstrating such artistry in 4- and 8-bar increments? Given the titanic solos of the modern day, one can safely assume that jazz fans will never again encounter such elegant concision. Above all, there was a magical chemistry between these two elements, Holiday's voice and Lester's sax, leading some to characterize the collaboration between these platonic friends as a musical romance. Holiday's accomplishments are all the more remarkable when one realizes the limitations within which she worked. Her range at best spanned a scant 1.5 octaves. Her voice, moreover, did not project strongly, unlike, say, a Bessie Smith, who also had a modest range, but could compensate by belting out a song to the back rows. Holiday lacked the scat-singing chops of an Ella Fitzgerald, the tonal purity of a Sarah Vaughan, the exuberance of a Louis Armstrong. But what she had more than made up for these deficiencies. Her mastery was rooted in an incomparable sense of timing, phrasing that was supple yet uncommonly relaxed, and above all, an ability to infuse a lyric with hitherto unknown depths of meaning. One might say that Billie Holiday was a stylist, not a virtuoso, unless emotional depth is a type of virtuosity. Her interpretations cut to the quick of a song, crafting a music of interiors, not surfaces. But the limitations that Holiday encountered went far beyond issues of vocal technique and are entangled in the terrible circumstances of her life and times. Holiday's story has been romanticized and dissected by turns. The romanticized version started with Holiday herself, who wrote an autobiography, Lady Sings the Blues, that mixed large doses of fiction with a smattering of facts. It came as no surprise that Hollywood made this book into a hit movie, further diluting the truth in the process. In later years, an ardent group of researchers, John Chilton, Linda Cool, Robert O'Mealy, Donald Clark, Stuart Nicholson, and others, would undertake their own analysis and reconstruction of Holiday's life. while the memoirs of those who knew her, such as John Hammond and Leonard Feather, have provided additional perspectives. Given this outpouring of research and commentary, there is certainly no lack of biographical material at hand. But most commentators have expected too much from Holliday's troubled life. They have wanted to twist it to reveal a moral or annotate it with a running apology or infuse it with a grandeur of Shakespearean tragedy. At the end of it all, there remains an enigmatic quality, an aura of mystery that surrounds Holliday's life and refuses to be dismissed. She has become much like the other overanalyzed pop figures of the last century, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, John Lennon, Michael Jackson, for whom the stacks of biographies, the abundance of explanations, the ardor of the fans, seem to bring us no closer to their essence. It is the essence we want to understand, and all we are given are an assortment of facts, anecdotes, and hearsay. In Holliday's case, even the simplest facts, a name, a date, a relationship, can prove stubbornly complex. She typically gave her birth name as Eleonora, but the hospital records show Eleanor, and the birth certificate states Eleanor. She could borrow one of her mother Sarah's last names, Harris or Fagan, and took on Gough when her mother married Phil Gough, and then changed back to Fagan again after their divorce. At other times, her last name was Holliday, or Holliday, or Halliday. In later years, she adopted the last name of husbands or boyfriends, Monroe, McKay, Guy, Levy, and formal names coexisted from the start with nicknames. At the House of the Good Shepherd in Baltimore, where she was institutionalized briefly during her youth, she was known as Madge or Teresa. Lester Young gave her the lasting nickname of Lady Day, and she responded by christening him Prez. Her father, Clarence Holliday, best known as a guitarist with the Fletcher Henderson Band, simply called her Bill. Her ultimate choice of Billie Holiday was deeply suggestive, affirming her ties with her absent father and his world of jazz music and traveling bands. Few of us get to choose our names, but Holliday went further. She recrafted her life story in articles, interviews, and ultimately her autobiography. As later researchers have come to learn, these excursions into fantasy could take any number of directions. At times, Billie would make her life sound more sordid than it actually was. At other moments, she would give it an unwarranted varnish of respectability. She tells of being born in Baltimore on April 7, 1915, although jazz writer Stuart Nicholson later showed that the location was Philadelphia, some 3 years before her parents married. In fact, the relationship between Clarence Holliday and Billie's mother, Sadie Fagan, both in their teens at the time, was a brief affair. No marriage record exists, and the singer's birth certificate lists Frank DeVise as her father. Clarence, for his part, took little heed of his parental responsibilities. He was reluctant to make any public acknowledgement that Billie was his daughter until her career blossomed. In later life, Billie would be attracted to men much like her father, glamorous, fast and loose, irresponsible, tough, worldly, traits that would also characterize the various no-good lovers who would populate her songs. During these years, Billie was often left in the care of relatives, where she was, by turns, abused, neglected, and possibly raped. In January 1925, a juvenile court declared her to be a minor without proper care and guardianship and placed her in the House of the Good Shepherd for a year. When she was released, she moved back with her mother, who by now had taken up with Wee Wee Hill, a philandering porter some 8 years her junior. Sadie and Hill soon moved to New York. Sometime in the late 1920s, Holliday followed them to the setting of her first musical triumphs. Little is known about Holliday's coming of age as a jazz singer. Recordings by Louis Armstrong and Bessie Smith apparently made an impression on her, but the differences between her and these predecessors are as striking as the similarities. Armstrong's carefree jocularity could play no role in Holliday's more doleful worldview, and while she borrowed some material from Smith's repertoire, Holliday was never primarily a blues singer, notwithstanding the title of her autobiography. But Holliday could take command of a lyric like no one else. Her 1936 recording for Brunswick, I Cried for You, the first standard she recorded and her biggest hit from the period, finds her wringing the tears from a song that so many other vocalists have delivered in a glib, matter-of-fact manner. Holliday interprets it as a melancholy torch song, even though the band is bouncing along at medium tempo. Years later, she would grip audiences by presenting the same song as a ballad. In 1933, John Hammond heard Holiday singing in a Harlem night spot and gave her career a boost with a glowing review in Melody Maker, heralding her as a real find and confiding that the 18-year-old vocalist sings as well as anybody I ever heard. Later that year, Hammond arranged for Holiday to sing with Benny Goodman. Other opportunities followed. A brief film appearance in Symphony in Black alongside Duke Ellington, a booking at the Apollo Theater, and more recordings, this time under Teddy Wilson's leadership, arranged by Hammond. During the remaining years of the decade, Holiday would make dozens of small combo sides, resulting in many of the finest works of her career. Even before her pairing with Lester Young, Holiday made her mark with classic renditions of What a Little Moonlight Can Do, These Foolish Things, I Cried for You, Billy's Blues, A Fine Romance, and I Can't Give You Anything But Love, among others. The soloists on these performances included some of the finest horn players in jazz, Benny Goodman, Ben Webster, Johnny Hodges, Harry Carney. But with the addition of Lester Young for a January 1937 session, Holiday found an even more sympathetic partner. Virtually all of the Holiday-Young sides are of lasting value. Even when burdened with a banal tune or awkward lyric, Now They Call It Swing, Me, Myself, and I Are All in Love with You, You're Just a No Account, Sun Showers, Holiday and Young were still able to create music of near perfection, and when working with stronger material, All of Me, Foolin' Myself, Mean to Me, He's Funny That Way, and This Year's Kisses, they left behind definitive performances that cast a long shadow over later attempts to interpret these songs. The same period saw Holiday slowly gain a following beyond the inner circle of jazz cognoscenti. Short stints with Count Basie and Artie Shaw broadened her audience, while Holiday's 1939 recording of Strange Fruit, a disturbing song about a lynching, added to her notoriety and imparted a piquant political quality to her public image. This shift was spurred at the behest of Barney Josephson, a former shoe salesman who had recently opened Cafe Society, a fashionable nightclub in the village. Josephson had introduced the song to Holiday and encouraged her to close each set with it. Over the next several years, Holiday gradually became less a jazz vocalist and more a torch singer. Her most characteristic works from this period were moody numbers such as Lover Man, I Cover the Waterfront, God Bless the Child, Good Morning Heartache, Don't Explain, and the aforementioned Strange Fruit. Billy's singing still exuded intense emotional commitment, but as the decade progressed, the quality of her sidemen steadily declined, and later her voice followed suit. By the middle of the 1940s, subpar jazz players or maudlin violins had replaced the all-star bands of earlier years. The travails of Holiday's personal life also became increasingly public during this period. Starting from her Baltimore days, Holiday had veered from the straight and narrow. Before her 15th birthday, she was smoking tobacco. In time, her habit would require 50 cigarettes per day and marijuana. In her teens, she worked in a brothel, and later shocked many readers with a candid account in her 1956 autobiography. Holiday also came to drink heavily. Some years later, her husband Jimmy Monroe introduced Holiday to heroin. Her ensuing addiction led to a series of problems with law enforcement agencies in the late 1940s. In 1947, she was forced to serve 10 months at the Federal Reformatory for Women in West Virginia. But even after her release, Holiday continued to pay a heavy price. She could no longer work in New York clubs because of a regulation, eventually repealed in 1967, that denied cabaret cards to convicted felons. Allowed to perform at theaters and auditoriums, Holiday was presented at a successful concert at Carnegie Hall, but a follow-up, Holiday on Broadway engagement at the Mansfield Theater, folded after 5 days. Barred from nightclubs, Holiday was essentially prevented from earning a living in New York. Even in other locales, Holiday found club owners reluctant to book her, either because of the stigma of her addiction or a reputation for unreliability. In 1949, Holiday was arrested again on drug charges while touring the West Coast, but was acquitted when she convinced the jury that she had been set up by her companion, John Levy. Sales and airplay of her recordings declined during this period as well, and in 1951, Decca refused to renew Holiday's contract. A downbeat reviewer smugly joked that Lady Day was becoming Lady Yesterday. In March 1952, Holiday signed with Norman Granz's Verve label and began the arduous process of rehabilitating her career as a jazz singer. Over the next 5 years, she would record over 100 songs for Granz, once again in the company of world-class jazz musicians. These included many of the finest saxophonists in jazz, albeit ones who played in a pre-bop style. Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, Benny Carter, Willie Smith, Flip Phillips, Paul Quinchet, along with such trumpeters as Harry Sweets Edison, Charlie Shavers, or Joe Newman. On piano, Holiday was supported by Oscar Peterson, Jimmy Rolls, or Wynton Kelly, all top-tier musicians. In Sideman, in material, in style, Granz was attempting to recreate the formula that had worked so well for Holiday during the pre-war years. Often she recorded the same songs with which she had made her reputation some two decades earlier. But Holiday's voice had changed. In the opinion of some, it had declined precipitously. The value of Holiday's late recordings remains a matter of debate among jazz fans. Her voice clearly showed the signs of strain, of wear. A darker quality now pervades the music. At times, a sense of despair infuses the performances. A streak of melancholy had always characterized Holiday's singing, but by now the touches of light were all but extinguished. Yet a trade-off was apparent. The deterioration in Holiday's vocal equipment was compensated for by even more nuanced performances. Holiday's phrasing, her timing, her ability to add chiaroscuro shades of meaning to a lyric remain unsurpassed on these late vintage recordings. And if Holiday could be a subpar vocalist, she was never an indifferent one. Miles Davis, in an oft-quoted assessment offered to Nat Hentoff in 1958, remarked on the greater maturity in Holiday's singing. "You know, she's not thinking now what she was in 1937, and she's probably learned more about different things. And she still has control, probably more control than then. No, I don't think she's in a decline." Altoist Jackie McLean, recalling this period in Holiday's career, explained, "Her voice was just a shadow of what it had been, yet she still put a song over. Her singing voice was gone, leaving emotion her only tool of expression." Holiday continued to struggle with heroin addiction and bouts of heavy drinking during these final years. In 1956, she was again arrested on a narcotics charge, this time in Philadelphia. But Holiday's self-assertiveness came to the fore that same year with activities on a wide range of fronts. Her autobiography was published by Doubleday. She performed to an enthusiastic audience at Carnegie Hall, and extracts from the book were narrated as part of the evening's entertainment. She continued to record and earn large fees for nightclub dates. The next year, Holiday appeared on a television show, The Sound of Jazz, fronting a superb band that also reunited her with Lester Young, and delivered a finely etched performance of Fine and Mellow. It is often cited with justification as the most moving jazz moment ever captured on film. Ultimately, physical dissipation, rather than artistic exhaustion, took its toll. Although beset by heart and liver problems, Holiday maintained an extensive touring schedule, including overseas appearances. At a Greenwich Village concert in May 1959, she had to be helped from the stage after singing only two numbers. A week later, she fell into a coma. At the hospital, Holiday showed signs of recovery, slowly regaining weight and beginning to dictate sections of a new book to her collaborator, Bill Dufty. Her legal problems, however, pursued her even into the hospital ward, with the police claiming that she was in possession of heroin and putting her under house arrest, going so far as to post agents outside the door of her room. Although Holiday responded to treatment for her liver, a kidney infection set in, and on July 17th, she died. At the time of her death, Holiday's bank account showed a balance of only 70 cents, but hospital workers who came to take the body found $750 taped to one of her legs, an instinctive gesture of self-preservation by one who, so often betrayed by those closest to her, had come to trust only in herself. Duke Ellington, middle period and later works. Duke Ellington would eventually benefit from the rising public interest in swing music generated by Goodman's success. Even so, the birth of the swing era came at a time when Ellington was increasingly distancing himself from the mass market demands of the music industry. At a point when jazz was becoming America's popular music, Ellington appeared singularly intent on transforming it into a serious art form. If there was any irony inherent in this situation, Ellington seemed blissfully unaware of it. Perhaps the most remarkable thing about this iconic figure during the heyday of the big bands was that, whatever conflicts there may have been between the demands of commerce and the higher aspirations of his muse, they forced few compromises in his music. Nowhere was Ellington's genius more evident than in this ability, ever so rare in any idiom, but especially in the jazz world, to achieve simultaneously the highest rung of artistic achievement and remain a celebrated mass-market entertainer. Yet Ellington never made it too easy for his audience. His music was laced with dissonances, his melodies were rarely hummable ditties, and could give even trained singers fits with their odd intervallic leaps. While most bandleaders featured a heavy dose of popular songs in their repertoires, Ellington relied to an extreme on his own pieces. True, Duke could compose hits, but these represented a tiny proportion of the band's output, dwarfed by the extended works, tone poems, ambitious pieces of program music, mini concertos for his soloists, novelty numbers, blues, reconfigured evocations of stride or New Orleans style, and experimental compositions of various sorts. Sometimes these forays into new territory would produce an unexpected hit, as happened with the Middle Eastern-tinged Caravan, Juan Tisol's contribution to the band from 1937. But more often, audiences were left to grope as best they could with a diminuendo and crescendo in blue, or a reminiscing in tempo, and even when Ellington offered a toe-tapping swing number, increasingly popular with audiences during this period, he rarely gave them the simple riff-based workhorses that other bands rode to success. Indeed, the riff, in essence a repeated motif over changing harmonies, sometimes given a syncopated kick through a displacement caused by a contrast between the length of the phrase and the underlying meter, may have been the undisputed musical signature of the era, as witnessed by the success of Opus 1, In the Mood, A String of Pearls, Flying Home, and other like numbers. But apparently no one had told Ellington. Instead, he challenged his fans with complex swing charts such as Cottontail or Braggin' in Brass, clearly two masterpieces of the genre, but the former dauntingly hard to sing along with, the latter impossible. Today, Ellington's conservative works in AABA song form are the best known, the most frequently recorded pieces of his oeuvre, but these represent only one facet of his complex musical personality. Ellington himself was always quick to emphasize his cavalier attitude to these pop song offerings. Solitude, he claimed, was written in 20 minutes when he needed another number to finish a recording session. In a sentimental mood, he explained, was tossed off to calm down a party veering out of control one night in Durham, North Carolina. Who could doubt that, at the crest of the public's craze for big band music, Ellington remained a reluctant participant in the mainstreaming of hot jazz. In 1936, with swing sweeping the country, Ellington recorded little and had no hits. That same year, his group fell to fifth place in the Metronome poll. Dozens of big bands were being formed around the country, but Ellington responded at the close of the year by initiating a series of combo recordings. Over the next 2 years, Ellington would be involved in making over 60 small group sides, but only one, Johnny Hodges' performance on Jeep's Blues, became a featured jukebox number. In 1937, Ellington continued to take the high road with his big band work, recording the ambitious Diminuendo in Blue and Crescendo in Blue, companion pieces that filled both sides of a 78. His biggest-selling release of the year, however, was the previously mentioned Caravan, an exotic piece with modal overtones that few bandleaders would have considered to be hit material. This apparent lull in the larger band's activity was deceptive. The Ellington Orchestra, with its leader now approaching his 40th birthday, was on the brink of its greatest period, a burst of creativity that would last until the recording ban of the war years. True, Ellington would continue to record outstanding material for the remainder of his life, but the sheer number of masterpieces produced by the band between 1938 and 1942 stands out even in the context of Duke's half-century career. Three additions to the band at the close of the decade, Billy Strayhorn, Ben Webster, and Jimmy Blanton, would contribute greatly to this explosion of artistry. But even before their arrival, Ellington was already increasing his output, both in quantity and quality. The year 1938 saw the band produce a number of classic sides. Steppin' Into Swing Society, the group's first recording of the year, set the tone for Ellington's growing focus on medium-tempo swing charts, another trademark sound of the era. A similar groove is evident on a number of outstanding 1938 tracks, most notably on the two features for Ellington's best brass soloists, Riding on a Blue Note, a jaunty showpiece for trumpeter Cootie Williams, and Boy Meets Horn, a memorable Rex Stewart performance that demonstrated Ellington's ability to extract depths of emotion from a simple device. In this instance, a half-valve effect on the cornet. Extremely fast virtuoso performances had never played a large role in the Ellington book, but with Braggin' in Brass, Ellington created a classic of the genre, a breathtaking chart stunningly executed by the band. These ventures into unadulterated swing did not prevent Ellington from continuing to develop his mood style. The band achieved especially memorable results on Blue Light, Lost in Meditation, Prelude to a Kiss, and A Gypsy Without a Song. As these performances made clear, Ellington was increasingly able to incorporate a wide array of stylistic devices into his mood pieces, plaintive blues calls, impressionistic harmonies, elements of romantic ballads, without destroying the overall unity of the performance. This ability to cover so much musical ground in a 3-minute song, reminiscent of Jelly Roll Morton's best efforts, would stand out as one of the most salient virtues of Ellington's mature work. One evening, toward the close of this fertile year, Ellington was approached after a performance in Pittsburgh by a young composer named Billy Strayhorn, who was intent on showing the bandleader one of his pieces. 16 years younger than Ellington, Strayhorn had spent his youth in many locales: Ohio, where he was born in Dayton in 1915, New Jersey, North Carolina, and finally Pennsylvania, where he eventually enrolled at the Pittsburgh Musical Institute. Here he pursued formal study of theory and concert music, supplemented by a private passion for jazz and songwriting. Shortly before his decisive encounter with Ellington, Strayhorn had been performing with a trio and studying orchestration, but most of his income came from his day job in a drugstore. This would soon change dramatically. The piece that caught Ellington's attention that night, Lush Life, stands out as one of the greatest jazz ballads, with its yearning melody line and the haunting poetry of its lyrics, supported by sweeping harmonies more characteristic of classical music than of Tin Pan Alley. Within weeks, Strayhorn was writing arrangements for the band, initiating a relationship with Ellington that would span almost 3 decades. During this period, he would compose or collaborate on over 200 pieces. Ellington had long indulged in various musical collaborations with his band members, but previously these relationships were unabashedly one-sided. Strayhorn, in contrast, became a true partner, playing a pivotal role in shaping the band's sound. In fact, a Strayhorn song, Take the A-Train, would eventually become the band's trademark theme. But this venture into the hit parade was atypical. Strayhorn's instincts were artistic, not commercial, and Ellington's choice of him as a musical alter ego no doubt reflected the bandleader's own aspirations as a serious composer. Especially in his own mood compositions, songs such as Chelsea Bridge, Daydream, Passion Flower, Lotus Blossom, A Flower is a Lovesome Thing, and Blood Count, Strayhorn's mastery rivaled his employer's. Such works remain the closest jazz has ever approached to art song. In 1939, Ellington continued to expand his efforts on many fronts. The combo sides took a high priority early in the year, but big band activity soon picked up, with the ensemble recording over a dozen numbers in March and June, including the riff-based Pussy Willow, the mood piece Subtle Lament, Billy Strayhorn's first major contribution, Grievin', and The Sergeant Was Shy with its evocation of Bugle Call Rag. In the spring, the band traveled to Europe for the second time, where Ellington celebrated his 40th birthday in Sweden. He was feted by a large group of serenading schoolchildren on the occasion, and he responded by recording Serenade to Sweden on his return to the States. In addition, Ellington also took a higher profile as an instrumentalist during the year, recording as a solo pianist, rare at the time for Duke, and in duet format with bassist Jimmy Blanton after the latter's arrival in the fall of 1939. The addition of Blanton represented a major turning point for the band. Half Ellington's age, this 20-year-old prodigy brought a palpable excitement, an incisiveness and momentum to virtually every performance during his brief tenure with the group. Despite his youth, Blanton's career would span months, not years. At the close of 1941, he would leave Ellington because of poor health and would die from tuberculosis the following July. but in that short time he managed not only to invigorate the Ellington rhythm section, but also to revolutionize the role of the string bass in jazz. There had been outstanding players on the instrument before Jimmy Blanton: Pops Foster, Steve Brown, Al Morgan, John Kirby, Wellman Broad, Billy Taylor, with Ellington at the time of Blanton's arrival, Walter Page, and others, but his virtuosity tended to eclipse their accomplishments. For all their virtues, they now seemed mere timekeepers, offering a steady beat and harmonic reinforcement, while Blanton was a complete jazz player. Today, the bass fills multiple roles in most jazz ensembles, propelling the performance, establishing a rhythmic pulse, providing embellishments, crisp walking lines, and countermelodies, and taking its place from time to time as a featured solo voice. Blanton helped define all these responsibilities. He showed that the plucked, pizzicato bass could be as important as the drums in swinging the band, in pushing an entire jazz orchestra. He, more than anyone else, established the bass as a legitimate solo voice in the jazz idiom. With a resonant tone and a polished execution unsurpassed at the time, he laid the foundation for modern jazz bass technique. One can hear the result not only in Blanton's own recordings, but in his pervasive impact on virtually all of the leading jazz bassists of the 1940s and 1950s, including Oscar Pettiford, Ray Brown, Charles Mingus, Red Mitchell, Paul Chambers, and Red Callender. "The most impressive bass player I ever heard was Jimmy Blanton," Callender later recalled. "When I first heard him, I said, 'This is the way the bass is supposed to be played.'" The arrival of Ben Webster, the third important addition to the band during this period, was a major coup for Ellington. A powerful soloist with a deeply personal sound, Webster ranks as the finest tenorist in the history of the Ellington Orchestra. His departure left a void that Ellington never adequately filled. At his best, Webster was on par with the most famous tenor players in jazz, mentioned by fans in the same breath as Hawkins or Young. His mature style revealed a mastery of the sonic possibilities of the tenor saxophone, unprecedented in jazz, exhibiting a dazzling range of breathy tones, raspy asides, barks, whimpers, growls, glissandos, cries, and whispers. His playing at times could be aggressive, as could his personality. The pugnacious Webster once claimed to have knocked down heavyweight champion Joe Louis, and who dared challenge the story? But his music was just as noteworthy for its gentler moments. While emulating the ripeness of Johnny Hodges's sound, Webster added to it a warmer, airy essence. His lingering tones had a delicious, unfocused quality. Eventually, he learned how to hint at phrases, a note or two sufficed, rather than state them explicitly, recalling the poet's remark that the unheard melodies are the sweetest of all. Yet Webster was just as adept at declamatory outbursts on the saxophone, leaving behind in his most famous Ellington solo on Cottontail a lasting tour de force of improvisational complexity. Born in Kansas City, Missouri on March 27, 1909, Webster developed his skills alongside some of the finest saxophonists in jazz, apprenticing in bands led by Benny Moten and Andy Kirk. After moving to New York in 1934, Webster worked for a time with Fletcher Henderson and Cab Calloway, among others, before joining Ellington on a regular basis in 1940. His tenure with the Duke would be brief. Webster left Ellington in 1943, rejoining the band for a short stint at the close of the decade, but soon departed again to pursue a successful career as a freelance performer and studio player. Ellington was also making important changes in his business dealings during this period. He parted ways with Irving Mills in 1939 and initiated a new arrangement with the William Morris Agency. Around this same time, Ellington also entered into a long-term relationship with the Victor recording label, signing a contract for 5 years. One suspects that the security of these new arrangements played some role in the burst of creativity that followed. At a minimum, Ellington must have been given enormous artistic freedom while at Victor. The sides he recorded for the label have only the lightest veneer of commercialism. They are full of subtleties and intricacies, arcane compositional structures, surprising modulations, hints of dissonance that may have endeared Duke to serious jazz listeners, but probably put off more casual fans. Ellington's frequent departures from standard song form warrant particular mention. By the time of the swing era, The 32-bar form had become entrenched as the dominant structure for both popular song composition and jazz improvisation. The most common variant employed 2 8-bar melodies, an A theme and a B theme, according to standard terminology, which were played in the sequence AABA. A second approach, even simpler in construction, was also frequently used. This was an AA prime form, in which both themes spanned 16 bars, and with only a slightly different ending distinguishing the A melody from the A prime version. These two structures, AABA and AA prime, remain dominant in jazz music to this day. In a typical performance, a jazz band will simply repeat the underlying structure over and over again in a constant 32-bar loop, with an opening and closing melody statement encapsulating improvisations over the same form. Certainly when the occasion so warranted, Ellington employed these simple 32-bar structures, especially when he was aiming for commercial acceptance. But just as often, Ellington broke out of this Tin Pan Alley straitjacket, at times squeezing 4 or more themes into a 3-minute song. And instead of restricting himself to 8 or 16-bar melodies, Ellington sprinkled his music with occasional sections of other lengths, lasting 10 or 20 bars or some even more lopsided duration, not to mention his frequent use of 12-bar blues structures. These melodies of different length often coexisted alongside each other in a single composition, where they might be further spiced with equally unconventional introductions, codas, or interludes. Ellington's famous recording of Jack the Bear from 1940 is, for the most part, a 12-bar blues driven by the stunning bass work of Jimmy Blanton. But midway through the piece, the song shifts gears into an AABA form. To a seasoned jazz musician, this immediate juxtaposition of blues and pop song form would be like eating spaghetti and pancakes at the same sitting. Yet Ellington not only pulls off this odd mixture without causing indigestion, but creates a masterpiece in the process. Sepia Panorama, also from this period, is another example of Ellington's predilection for arcane forms. Its four-theme structure unfolds ABCDDCBA, with the second half of the song serving as a mirror image of the first. Once again, the melodies vary in length, but the A and D themes follow a 12-bar format, while the B and C sections are built on standard 8 and 16-bar structures. Moreover, the moods of the various sections are strikingly different, with a pensive B theme separating the more energetic A and C sections, and the two improvised D choruses featuring the outstanding blues work of Ellington, Blanton, and Webster. This represented a level of complexity that swing fans, raised on a diet of simple riffs, may well have found puzzling. But Ellington dared to be different, even using Sepia Panorama as the band's theme song during this period. Sometimes he might simplify matters in performance, just playing the opening sections of the work, but often he treated audiences to a full-blown version. A live recording of the band made in Fargo, North Dakota, on November 7, 1940, a neglected masterpiece on a par with Ellington's more celebrated Carnegie Hall performances, or sacred concerts, captures a vibrant 5-minute rendition of Sepia Panorama, with Blanton and Webster playing at absolute top form. The Fargo tracks, taken as a whole, are important documents of Ellington's 1940 band, showing that the complex and challenging pieces that were a specialty of this ensemble could also serve as spirited, hot jazz for a dancing audience. Indeed, there are few other recordings of the Ellington band in any setting that find the group playing with such energy and verve. There was no contradiction in this for Ellington. His artistry was just as much at home in a dance hall in North Dakota as on the stage of Carnegie Hall. Ever so gently and politely, he raised the audience to his level wherever he went, and the band's aficionados invariably learned to expect the most inspired performances in some of the humblest venues. The Ellington recorded legacy from the beginning of the 1940s is extraordinarily rich. The Victor sides from this period rank with the finest achievements of the jazz idiom, on a par with Armstrong's Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, or with the Charlie Parker Savoy and Dial sessions. Where to begin? The ominous Coco, with its throbbing pedal tones, evokes Ellington's jungle music of earlier years, but now drawing on an even darker palette, almost despairing in its tone. If one didn't know that a world war was in the making, one could almost guess it from this foreboding musical portrait. Harlem Airshaft is poised at the opposite end of the spectrum, jubilant, spirited, carefree. Midway through the piece, Ellington toys with his audience. The rhythm section suddenly drops out, and the horns articulate a more reflective theme in halftime. Has the party ended prematurely? Not at all. After a moment of pregnant hesitation, drummer Sonny Greer leads the band back in full force. This cat-and-mouse game is repeated twice, a masterpiece of deferred gratification. Some of the band's loveliest ballads and mood pieces date from this period, but the surprise is that many of them are written by sidemen. No doubt Ellington's creativity in this vein was still at peak form, as witnessed by All Too Soon, Warm Valley, and Dusk, but Strayhorn's Chelsea Bridge, Mercer Ellington's Blue Surge, and Juan Tizol's Bakif also stand out as first-class works. Yet this was more than a writer's band. Anyone doubting the improvisational talent of the Ellington Orchestra need only hear Cootie Williams on Concerto for Cootie, Ben Webster on Cottontail, Jimmy Blanton on Pitter Panther Patter, or Johnny Hodges on Main Stem. In fact, it is hard to think of any other body of recordings in the jazz idiom that reflect such an ideal balance between composition, orchestration, and improvisation as these Ellington efforts from the early 1940s. A number of circumstances conspire to put an end to this fertile period in the history of the Ellington Band. Cootie Williams decided to join Benny Goodman in November 1940, after 11 years with Ellington. Jimmy Blanton left the band in November 1941 and died from tuberculosis a few months later. In the summer of 1942, Barney Bigard departed, and a month later vocalist Ivy Anderson followed suit. This exodus continued in 1943, with Ben Webster leaving the band. The middle years of the decade also saw the departure of Rex Stewart, Juan Tizol, Tricky Sam Nanton, felled by a stroke, and Otto Hardwick. After years of relying on stable personnel, Ellington now had to cope with an unprecedented level of turnover. Nor was this all. The larger problems of the music industry also served to curtail his activities. A 1941 conflict between ASCAP, which represented composers, and the nation's radio broadcasters, effectively limited Ellington's access to airplay, although it did give him a financial incentive to feature songs written by Strayhorn and other band members who were not ASCAP members. Then, for almost 2 years, Ellington was kept out of the recording studio due to the prolonged strike called by James Petrillo, the hard-headed boss of the American Federation of Musicians. Fans looked on in dismay as the majestic and prolific recorded output of 1938 to 41 was followed mostly, at least for a spell, by silence. This enforced hiatus and the dramatic turnover in the band did little to stem Ellington's ambitions. His attention increasingly turned to longer works in a jazz vein. Undeterred by the failure of his show Jump for Joy, which had been staged for 11 weeks in Los Angeles in 1941, Ellington pushed on with his most daring composition to date, Black, Brown, and Beige. For over a decade, Ellington had talked about his desire to write an extended work that would serve as a musical depiction of African-American history. The scope of this project constantly shifted. At one point, it was to be a symphony, at another, an opera or musical. The end result was none of these. Instead, Ellington put together a three-part work lasting three quarters of an hour and scored for jazz band and voice. Given Ellington's stature, this alone would have been a major event in the music world, but his choice of Carnegie Hall for a venue, this was his debut performance in the venerable auditorium, only added to the notoriety surrounding Black, Brown, and Beige. In the eyes of some, Ellington was doing more than writing an extended work. He was challenging the bastions of serious music. The critical response to the piece was far from receptive. Paul Bowles, writing in the New York Herald Tribune, not only chastised the composer, but made pronouncements about the proper scope of jazz. The whole attempt to fuse jazz as a form with art music should be discouraged, a judgment with the ominous ring of the plantation owner denouncing his uppity slaves. But even listeners who might have been more sympathetic, such as John Hammond, lamented that Duke was deserting jazz. In truth, Black, Brown, and Beige was an impressive work, despite minor imperfections. The first movement includes some of the most sophisticated examples of thematic development Ellington would ever write, along with one of his strongest melodies, Come Sunday, presented in an impassioned saxophone statement by Johnny Hodges. The highlight of the second movement is the unexpected entry of a vocal part built on an unusual pyramid form of lyric. The blues. The blues ain't. The blues ain't nothing. The blues ain't nothing but a cold gray day. This section was followed in the Carnegie Hall performance by an outstanding tenor solo by Ben Webster. The third movement, Beige, is a less structured sequence of disparate themes, each representing Ellington's musical evocation of a specific aspect of African-American history or culture. The insertion of a waltz interlude was noteworthy at the time, given the rarity of this meter in jazz settings. But Beige as a whole is less cohesive than Black and Brown.